Case number 12-5410. Handmade Dula, detainee, and Waqi Khan as next friend to Hamdi Dula, appellant, versus Barack Hussein Obama, President of the United States et al. Mr. Connolly for the appellant, Ms. Swingle for the appellees.
Thank you. May it please the court, John Connolly on behalf of Hamidullah and Waqil Khan. Waqil is the father of Hamidullah. Our position, we're not going to reiterate the arguments that have been presented this morning by the other petitioners in Amanatullah and Makala, but our view is that the fact that my client, my child client, Hamidullah, who was 14 when he was detained and he's 19 today, the fact that he is a minor and has been a minor throughout his detention changes fundamentally the analysis that courts have used throughout history in terms of recognizing habeas jurisdiction and exercising habeas jurisdiction.
Is that right? Did you find any cases on jurisdiction? I mean, the cases that you cited us were all, weren't jurisdictional cases, they were all merits cases.
Well, I think to some degree they're jurisdictional cases. The jurisdictional line that I cite that deals with children is relates to where the custodian is located.
Right.
And in particular, it's our view, based on the line of authority that we've cited, when the custodian, including private custodians in many cases for children, is within the jurisdiction, the courts have required that custodian to make a return even if the children have been spirited away from the jurisdiction. And in the context of the cases that I've cited, mostly it's been from state to state, but they're mm-hmm. in state courts. So if a father in Iowa moves his children to Missouri, often the return would say something like, the children are not, the habeas petitioner is not in the jurisdiction. The courts will say that, in fact, the father must make a return and establish that he does not have control over those children to bring them back into the jurisdiction. So to some degree, I do think that there is a jurisdictional component to it. But more importantly, or not more importantly, but more broadly, it seemed to us, when I looked at all these cases, all these old treatises, that habeas cases at habeas courts at common law were much more flexible about recognizing, ensuring that children who were in detention would have some form of remedy. And it's not beyond comprehension, and I think it's well within the sort of the scope of the available case law from the early part of the Republic that a habeas court would have recognized jurisdiction for a child who had no other opportunity in a civil court to bring a case to test the lawfulness of his detention.
The cases you're referring to would support relief if your client had been spirited out of a jurisdiction where there was habeas jurisdiction, but you're not claiming that, right?
Well, I'm claiming that the custodian is within the jurisdiction of this court, namely it's the President and the Secretary of Defense.
That's a given in all these cases.
That's correct. But we're also contending that based on the historical cases, the object of the return wasn't so much that they were spirited out, like in Ex Parte Endo. It was that the parent, or the custodial parent, was within the jurisdiction of the court and had to establish to the court's satisfaction that he did not have control to bring the children back into the jurisdiction. Because in the case of children, as I've tried to make clear in my brief, there are different interests at stake. The parent himself has an interest in the child. It's not just about the child, because as we've set forth, children aren't necessarily going to be released on their own recognizance. They're not going to be, you know, in the classic sense of habeas, they're not going to be brought to the courthouse door and set free. They're going to be released to another custodian. So our contention is in part that this has a jurisdictional component to it, and because the custodians who are effectively acting in loco parentis for one of my clients, they've taken my other client's right to the custody of his child, and they've exercised control over that child, and they are in this jurisdiction. They're the people who have ultimate control over his body, as it were. And so, I mean, but I do think that you have to look at the reason why habeas courts and why modern courts look at detention of children so much differently, I think, than detention of adults. And it's because, as the Convention on the Rights of the Child sets forth, and as many other international norms and standards set forth, detention of children is fundamentally different than detention of adults. It's so much more damaging. My client detained from 14 through 19. That's more than a quarter of his life. And as so far as we know, he hasn't been segregated from the adult population. He hasn't been given an education. He certainly hasn't been given access to his family, to his teachers, to his clerics, to his support system. And when you take that from a child, you've taken, and this is society's recognition, both in modern times and I would contend in old times, society recognizes that if you deprive that child of that much time in prison, by putting him in prison, you're depriving him of an opportunity to grow into a well-developed and well-adjusted adult. And so at common law, courts recognize that. Habeas was the form of relief that courts adapted to ensure that children were not in unlawful forms of custody. In modern days, we had many, many different statutory regimes where courts are very solicitous of the rights of children, this court, I'm sure, is very well aware of the best interests of the child standard. That standard actually comes, so far as I can tell, from the original habeas cases. It comes from common law cases in England where courts first started saying, because remember, habeas usually has one of three outcomes: remand, bail, or discharge. In habeas cases, courts for the first time started saying, "Well, wait, which is the better custody for this child? Is the father, who you usually would have custodial rights of the parent, actually a bankrupt? Is he beating the child?" That this comes from habeas law. That's where it first started, and it took root in this country in the early cases that I've cited in my brief.
You fit this into the jurisdictional analysis.
Yes. Well, I fit it in under both status and adequacy of the process for determining status and also
yes.
Practical.
Yeah, I just get it. Well, that actually is telescoped by Jen in the same.
Right. And that's
but I guess the particular points you make about children raise serious problems about the merits. Of course, one doesn't get to the merits. It's not clear how this seems at all parallel to the kind of status issues that the court looked at in Bookman.
Well, of course, I've made a long argument in my brief about why I believe that this does fit within the status prong of Bookman. I mean, even just taking the common sense meaning of the word status, childhood is a status at law. It always has been a status.
Yeah,
it's
a textual matter.
It's true. Okay, so
the context is what Boumediene is talking about.
Right, and within the context of Boumediene, what we have is we have the enemy combatant as one status, and we only know of one other status point, which is war criminal from Eisentrager, which this court relied on and distinguished, and which Boumediene distinguished. So we have two points that sort of. That's the context of status as we know it, and what I've argued in the brief is that those are not the only points on the detainee status continuum. There are many different types of statuses that are recognized in law, including, the United States has a whole taxonomy set up for different types of detainees: retained personnel, chaplains and medical personnel, spies and saboteurs. They all have different rights when they're detained. And that is what Boumediene was getting at. And what I've contended at some length in my brief is that the status of overwhelming significance since the 1949 Geneva Conventions right up through today that really is more important than any other status is childhood. And convention after convention, domestic, international authorities from 1949 through 2008 state very, very clearly that it is a worldwide imperative that we are going to eradicate the problem of child soldiers. And I stress, we have no evidence in this record that my client was a child soldier. The evidence only suggests that he was a child. But even if he's a child soldier, these domestic and international norms establish beyond any doubt, in our contention, that the policy of the United States and the world is to ensure that that children are demobilized, rehabilitated, and reintegrated. And it is particularly so when the children are under 15. It is a war crime to under both the Rome Statute and under domestic law, the Child Soldiers Prevention Act, to use a child who is under 15, even with the child's consent. And as I've set forth in our brief, if we could find the person who conscripted my client, if that in fact happened, the United States would assert jurisdiction, and he were found in the United States. The United States would assert jurisdiction over that person to in a criminal trial. That's the Child Soldiers Accountability Act of 2008. So I think that this is, you really don't have to work very hard to fit childhood into the status taxonomy in the Boumediene. I've also argued, however, that there's a difference for practical obstacles when the detainee is a child. And as I've laid out in the brief, one point that you have to remember is that at habeas, the parent has his own right to bring a habeas case. So Wakil Khan, who is my second client in this case, he has his own right to bring a habeas case. He could bring it without Hamidullah's consent. He could even bring it at common law if Hamidullah had consented to the custody. He has an independent right. So in a very real sense, what we have here is a case that could be brought by a parent of a child, and that case could proceed as any other civil case in the United States, and the evidence could be presented through the parent, at least. And the parent actually would have much better evidence of the age of the child, to the extent that that's going to be a threshold issue, which is what we argue in our brief. A parent actually knows the age of the child better than the child does, as the record in this case actually establishes, because although the government doesn't contest it on appeal in the court below, they actually put in just a modicum of evidence doubting the age of my client. So I think there are other reasons why the practical obstacles are diminished for children. The chief among them is that there should be very few children who are detained by the United States. What the government argued below, not so much on appeal, is that actually we do pick up a lot of children, and that's to the great, you know, that's exactly the problem. The United States and other countries do pick up children in wartime. That's part of the scourge of war, is that children get caught up in it. But the domestic and international policies are that you release and rehabilitate those children. And in fact, as far as I can tell, that's what the United States
after says. Detention, right?
There can in fact be a period of detention, right. But that's the last resort. That's what the norms say. And children should have an opportunity, more than any other people, to ensure that their detention is lawful. All that we are asking this court is for the government to come in and justify that it has the lawful authority to hold a child for 5 years through his...
Yeah, he hasn't been cleared for release, is that right?
No, we contend that he has been, although we've argued, it's what we allege in our petition is that he's told his family that there is no evidence against him, which I believe is effectively the same thing. We don't have any access to our client either, so there's no way for us to prove that he's been cleared for release, because the government won't tell us. But that is our allegation in the brief. We also allege, as the other petitioners do, that our client was transported from Pakistan to Afghanistan, so we have the evasion issue. The government does, to some degree, contest that. It's put in an affidavit saying he was captured in Pakistan. In Afghanistan. But that's contested by us as well. I see that my time is up. I'm happy to continue, but if the court has no questions, thank you very much.
Ms. Swingle.
Thank you, Judge Henderson. Obviously, a number of the arguments that Petitioner Hamidullah raises today turn on his minor status. And just to be clear, he is no longer a minor. He is 19, nearly 20 years old.
But the record that was compiled against him was compiled against him when he was a minor, and that makes a difference, doesn't it?
Initially, Your Honor, but
in civilian courts, that's an issue, right?
Well, I will say a couple of things. One, there have been periodic detainee review boards every 6 months. The most recent of those was held in April of this year, so after the age of his adulthood.
How old was he when the first one was held?
The first one was held in 2009.
So how old was he then?
By his accounts, right, that would be 15, 16. Okay. To be clear, each detainee review board is told to review de novo the lawfulness of continued detention. And while certainly some of the same evidence or information would likely be considered, it is a de novo review each time, and he was given an opportunity to make a statement or to testify at his choice in the most recent proceedings. So,
is the de novo review of the lawfulness of the initial detention or just the...
I believe it's of the continued detention.
Of the continued detention. So it's there's an element of safety, present safety. If he was released right now, would he pose a harm, right? Is that,
well,
that's part of the...
as with the other detainees, I mean, the procedures provide for a review of the lawfulness of detention. So whether someone meets the criteria for detention under the AUMF and the laws of war, and then there is a separate discretionary determination whether other measures could mitigate the risk, so whether there could be a discretionary transfer or release. So that first determination has been made, and he has been consistently found to be lawfully detained. And I just want to...
Just to be clear, each of the successive DRB determinations can, to the extent that there's new evidence or something, overturn the original decision on detainability.
Absolutely, Your Honor. As I said, and it is explicit in the review procedures, it is de novo review of the lawfulness of continued detention. Mm-hmm. So that has occurred since the period of his adulthood. In addition, you know, the district court did what I think petitioner is not doing for you today, which is to actually look at age under the rubric of the Boumediene factors. I think the argument today would sort of suggest that any time an individual is a minor, no matter what the circumstances were attaining to his detention, the place of detention, that would be enough in itself to have habeas jurisdiction. What the district court did, and I think properly, was to assume that even if an individual's status as a juvenile is a relevant status under Boumediene, and I think there are questions about whether that's correct, given what the court seems to envision status means. But even if that's right, you still have to look at all three factors. And here, you know, the court's prior Amakula decision found that the third factor weighed overwhelmingly against habeas jurisdiction. And as the district court found, that would not be better for juvenile detainees. In some ways, it would be worse because it raises this additional and very difficult question about how to evaluate the age of detainees. It would give an incentive to younger soldiers to falsely claim that they were minors at the time they were picked up. And it would still have all of the difficulties that the court had previously identified about litigating these issues with detainees who are being held in an active combat zone. So I think that would be, to the extent the court thought it was a relevant status under Boumediene, the appropriate analysis. Of course, both in Boumediene and in Amakula, the court treated status as something equivalent to whether a person had been found to be detainable as an enemy combatant or had been convicted by a military commission. I think this idea that status encompasses any potentially legally relevant factor about somebody is a little hard to square with the fact that the Boumediene court found that status was something different from citizenship, which is obviously a legally recognized status as well. If I can just add a couple...
But is there anything in Boumediene that precludes inquiry into the age as a status inquiry?
Well, I think it doesn't appear to be what the court was talking about when it talked about status, but no, I don't think there's anything that precludes it.
There were no children who were petitioners there.
Well, in fact, I will say Omar Khadr did file a brief before the Boumediene court asking that whatever the court otherwise did, it should carve out kind of a special exception for individuals who were juveniles and being subjected to military commissions. So the Supreme Court was aware that some of the petitioners, or I guess I think he was technically a respondent in the case, but that some of the individuals being held at that time at Guantanamo were minors. And if I just may respond to one thing, although this is not in the record, there are some public source materials I could cite the court to, I believe, but the minor detainees at Bagram have been housed separately. They have been provided with education and with some religious training. So that's just simply not factually accurate. And if the court is interested, we'd be willing to provide more information on that. If the court has no other questions.
All right. Thank you. All right, Mr. Connolly, why don't you take a minute?
very quickly, that my client had his most recent DRB in April this year. That's the first time I've heard of that. The point that children are segregated from adults in housing, that may be true. Of course, I can't verify that one way or another. The problem in this case, however, is that they got my child's age wrong, which is one of the reasons why we're here. If you look at the record below, you'll see how they try to justify why what they did was they put in just a little bit of evidence saying that, oh, we weren't sure that he was actually how old you're saying he was. So I don't think they segregated my client, and that's not what counsel has represented. I'm not blaming counsel for it. She said that's what they do. But there's no representation in this record that my client was segregated from housing. So I would just close by saying this is not a homeless or stateless person. This is an individual who comes from a stable family with a father and mother who miss him, who look for him every day, who went looking for him when he went missing. He's got brothers and sisters who miss him. All he wants is all they want is a chance to show that his detention is unlawful, and I don't think that's too much to ask. So I would request that the court vacate the judgment below and remand for hearing on the merits. Thank you very much.
Thank you.